Welcome to Out There with TJ Ryan. It's strange. It's unusual. It's mysterious. It's out there, out there, out there, out there. And now your host, TJ Ryan.
Well, there's been several incidents reported that are pretty well known up here and where I live, and even in other parts of Michigan and other parts of the country. So I thought, you know, it'd be kind of neat to get a hold of William Konkoleski. He is the director of MUFON in Michigan. How you doing, Bill?
Dynamite. And yourself?
Great. And how long have you been director of MUFON, Michigan?
2004, so it makes it 8 years and some change now.
And what got you interested in doing that?
Well, as a little kid, I had UFO sightings and unusual happenings. And growing up, watching In Search Of, I always thought it would be the coolest thing to tackle these mysteries head on. And as an adult, I came into contact with the Mutual UFO Network, and I came aboard, and here I am.
Yeah, you know, I wonder how many other people watching that show, because I know exactly what you're talking about, that show In Search Of. I wonder how many other people were inspired to go and find answers to things. Now, you said you had a UFO incident. What happened back when you were young like that?
I had a number of things that I could probably bring up. It would take quite a while to sort through everything, but the one that I always point to is the one that got me involved with MUFON. I was in high school. Me and two buddies, we were parked in front of another friend's house waiting for her to come home from work. It was about 9 o'clock. This was February 1989. And while we were parked in front of her place, we saw a blue ball of light about the size of a car, about the height of two telephone poles, fly slowly over our vehicle, kind of in an arc. And then when that light disappeared, suddenly a white ball of light zigzagged all over the sky. Like, and when I say all over the sky, I mean all over the sky. And then that disappeared, and then suddenly a red ball of light appeared in the center of the sky, and then that faded.
Wow.
And we're like, you know, what's that? You know, and we're like, do we tell the police? And they're like, you know, they are not really going to buy a bunch of high school kids reporting a UFO. And so one of my other friends said, hey, maybe we should tell the local Selfridge Air National Guard base. And we're like, no, I don't really think we want to talk to the military about this. So we didn't know what to do or who to report it to. We did tell some friends, and oddly enough, at work the next day, one of my coworkers spotted the blue ball of light himself. So there was an additional witness to it. And it was several years later that a friend of mine clued me into MUFON, and so I reported there that particular event, other events, and then suddenly I got really actively involved and still part of the group now, going on nearly 20 years after I first made my first report.
So how many UFOs have you spotted in your life?
Several. to count them, boy, that's a conversation right there. Mm-hmm. But I would say probably, gosh, if we're looking for a technical answer, I might throw the number a dozen at you.
Okay, now would you say that you've had really close up sightings, or some of them may be kind of vague and maybe something you can't identify?
I've seen unusual things, but I would dismiss it if, like, it could be an airplane or it could be some sort of misidentification. As an investigator, we try to filter out as many things as could be, like, a blimp or a plane or something like that. So in my tally that I just gave, I rule out anything that I was certain or could have even possibly been an airplane misidentified.
So in other words, you've had many more sightings and you're not sure of those, but these dozen maybe are something you can't really explain, can you?
correct.
Okay. So now when I had sent you an email, I was going to ask you about a couple of incidents, you know, since I'm based out of Upper Michigan. Mm-hmm. There was one, and I had a man on my show who actually had a lot of knowledge about the incident. The Kinross incident, was that back in, what, 52 or 53?
Yeah, 53. It was November of 53. It was when the war with Korea was winding down. Well, it was actually technically over at that point. But there was, from what I understand, a good deal of concern that some terrorist activity might take place on the Sulak. Or there was good reason to have the military base up there prepared just in case of any possible sabotage. So they were ramped up and ready to go should anything happen. And, well, in November of 53, something did happen, and that they had an unidentified flying object over Lake Superior. Well, actually, it started off over the locks themselves, which really raised red flags because that was the very thing that they were most nervous about. And then the object flew out over Lake Superior, and they dispatched a F-89 Scorpion after it. And as the plane got close to the UFO on their radar, they seemed to merge. The two objects seemed to merge and then suddenly disappear.
Yeah, that was the flight of Eugene Moncla, and he also had the radar operator or the navigator on the plane. Both of those two men disappeared, right? And some eyewitnesses,
yeah, Robert Wilson,
and the people that were radar operators on land said it's like the plane got absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
And they never found any wreckage, did they?
Well, there is a sequel of sorts to the story. Now, several years had passed, and, well, many years. We're talking more than 50 years had passed. In 2006, there was a dive company. Let me put that in quote, dive company, because it was found out that these guys really weren't who they said they were.
Mm.
But they had reported that they actually found the wreckage of both the UFO and the plane at the bottom of Lake Superior.
Mm.
They weren't going to tell anybody until they had produced a documentary and were able to salvage this stuff effectively. But all of that was coming in due time. And then MUFON did an investigation, found out that the company that these guys represented didn't exist. They were pseudonyms, the names that were given by these two gentlemen.
So why did they do that?
Gentlemen.
Why did they do that, Bill?
Well, I think it was based off the success of the fraudulent Roswell abduction video that was a big hit on Fox TV and on the Internet for a while.
Somebody was trying to make a buck. Somebody was trying to...
exactly. Okay. It was a hoax to try to get money and then... try to disappear. So, but they were found out before they were able to produce anything, so they never came out with their documentary.
So what the evidence that you've read, do you think that there was something unusual out there that day in 1953?
Yeah, everything seems to point that it was highly unusual. One of the things that the U.S. government tried to do was to try to push a more prosaic explanation for the crash. In fact, they were saying that the jet actually collided with a Canadian plane mm-hmm. that was out over Lake Superior. And the Canadians say, yeah, we do fly planes out, obviously, over the lake from time to time, but don't pin this on us.
Right.
We didn't have a plane in the area at that time.
Right, and there was no planes that went down from the Canadians. Now, also, in 72, when there was a UFOs that were over the Mackinac Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know about that story?
To my knowledge, there is really only one witness on this, but, he's got a fairly good case. He's got a fairly solid story. It was a gentleman, he was a Air Force traffic controller, and he had reported this to Stephen Greer of the Disclosure Project,
mm-hmm.
and Stephen Greer heavily publicized this, as well as several other UFO cases he was trying to give out to the public. But in this particular case, it was the fall of 72. Don't have an exact date on it. According to the story, there were three UFOs that were parked over the Mackinac Bridge, the northern part of the bridge, and the radar operator, the gentleman who was the air traffic controller, he was stationed north of St. Ignace, south of Kinchlow Air Force Base, which is actually Kinross,
right.
Just by with a new name. But he was getting several calls from the police saying, hey, you know, we've got these UFOs hovering over the bridge. Do you see them? Do you see them on your radar? And he was told very explicitly that if anybody ever asked, do you see anything strange on radar, to instantly just say, no, I don't see anything. There's nothing there. Even though if you do see something there, you're still supposed to say that, no, you don't see anything.
Right.
So he gave him the line. He didn't see anything, and yet he did, in fact, see something. He actually contacted NORAD as well, who said that they also, they were able to double-check the returns, and they were able to spot these UFOs as well. And then after being parked over the bridge for some time, one of the three UFOs decided to do a loop around Mackinac Island, come back, and then the three UFOs took off up 75, and then the sheriff's department decided they were going to try to give chase, and so they loaded up some police cars and headed up I-75 north of St. Ignace to try to chase after the UFOs. And the guy, when Smith realized, oh my gosh, you're coming my way, I can probably just step out of my my radar station here and get a good look at this myself. So he does just that. He steps out of his radar station and sees these UFOs flying up the road, giant blue balls of light, with the police cars giving chase. And then before the UFOs disappeared, as they were still headed up the general path of where I-75 was taking them, Kinchlow had two B-52s incoming, ready to land at the airbase, and the two planes were actually diverted away from the airbase because they didn't know what would happen. Didn't want them to collide with the UFOs, didn't want the UFOs to target them, didn't want anything to do with them. It was perceived that there was a chance that the bombers had nuclear material, and that would have been a great reason to try to avoid any sort of collision.
So,
and then the UFOs zipped off.
And that was reported by our radar. Do we know the name of this radar operator at all?
Michael Smith is the name of the guy.
Okay. And as I read online about him, he had been stationed in other locations, different parts of the country, where he had witnessed things as well, as I recall.
Yeah, in Oregon and other places.
Yeah. And so it always was where you had to keep quiet about it. Let me ask you this on a personal level, Bill. Who do you think these beings are? Are there several different races? I mean, what is your gut feeling? Or I'm sure you must have a thought on it.
The type of question that it really begs the bigger question: how far down the rabbit hole do you want to go? on a very basic level, obviously we're seeing more and more now that there are other inhabitable planets out there, and signs of life even in our closest neighbors like Mars and possibly the moons and in our solar system. Some of them show some pretty telling signs that there could have actually been life on them at some point. And so it seems to be pretty much common sense that we're not the only things going on right now in the universe. So if you take another planet out there and say their path through history has them maybe even a couple hundred years ahead of us technologically, just based upon how far we've gotten in the last century, you'd have to think that they're capable of some pretty amazing things. Now extrapolate that out to a civilization that could be 1,000 years ahead of us, a couple thousand years ahead of us, maybe even a million or more years ahead of us. And you would have to think, yeah, they could probably get to our planet if they wanted to, no problem. Now, the where it gets kind of crazy is that when you have technology advanced that far, you have to think that they're going to be capable of some things that we can't even dream of. It could be that they are able to warp space and time. They're able to do, bend the laws of physics in ways that we can't imagine. All sorts of things that would explain some of the more high strangeness cases that we tend to see. Now, since we don't have the technology, we don't even have the language to explain much of what we're seeing. All we know is that if you take, you know, another culture out there that's technologically advanced of ours, you know, for many, many years, you know, anything is possible. So do I think that there are some species coming from other planets to ours? Yes, I think that's entirely possible. Is it possible that some of these things are coming across some sort of interdimensional veil? Who knows? They could be time travelers. It's very hard to say. It could be all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you given enough time, the human species, you know, if you look at, you know, in your crystal ball, see a couple hundred years from now what we're capable of doing, I think.
Being extinct. I think we're capable of being extinct, Bill. The way we're going, who knows, right? So I guess what I was asking was, you know, there's been reports of like a handful of different main races that people have had interaction with over the years. And have you come across any of that in your investigations with MUFON?
Yeah, the no surprise, the little gray guys are the top of the list. They tend to come in two different flavors. One is about 3 feet tall. Another group of about 5 feet tall. The 3 feet tall ones, they tend to be more drone-like. They don't tend to interact well with people in terms of you can't have a good conversation with them, so to speak. But the 5 feet tall ones, they seem to grasp us a little bit better, and they seem to be able to communicate with us.
So you think it's two different races, perhaps?
You know, and that's really hard to say, too. I mean, if you look at all the possible variables, it could be that they are two species that evolved on the same planet. Maybe one species just evolved, you know, maybe they have a common ancestor, but one of them just evolved a little bit along higher, you know, at a better rate. It's possible that these things are actually synthetic robots of some sort, and that they have a sort of a plug-in intelligence based upon their job duty. And so the basic physical model remains the same. The height changes based upon, you know, the processing power of what's plugged in. You know, I mean, we're talking, you know, anything is on the table here. You know, it's very hard to even try to guess.
What about the ones that are 4 feet tall? Is that kind of the same category as about 3 feet or what?
I guess it would all be an estimation of height based on the witness. Is there something besides them being little gray guys that you are thinking of with somebody that's about that tall?
I had an experience back in 1992, which I never reported to MUFON because I wasn't sure if it was a dream or not. But over the years, I came to realize I'm pretty sure it wasn't. But I woke up in the bedroom one night in my mom's house, and there was approximately 4 feet tall, I'm guessing, one of those gray creatures, and it was staring at me in the bed. And the whole reason it was there is because I really wanted it to happen. I remember thinking about it when I was going to bed. At least that's what I believe. And when I woke up, it froze me with its thought, and I couldn't move, and I was sitting up. And then a thought hit me that if I had no intention of hurting this being, it would kind of let me go a little bit. And I thought to myself, no, I don't want to hurt him. I just wanted to see if he's real. And right after I thought that, all of a sudden I could start moving my arms a little bit, my chest, and of course I could breathe a lot easier. I was so scared, hyperventilating, and then my head a little bit, and then I was out like a light. And I woke up the next morning, and it was very vivid. And I thought, well, it's just a dream, but how often do you remember your dreams that clearly unless you wake up right after them?
Exactly, yeah.
And so I was pretty sure it was a visitation because I feel that we can communicate with them mentally. Have you heard that before, or am I one of those?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's actually common.
And so this creature, I would say, was 4 feet tall. And in no way was it, you know, it could have done anything it wanted. And I don't recall any strange probes, but then again, who knows after that what happened.
Yeah,
Go ahead. I was just going to say that was my, you know, my experience. And I've heard other people say that sometimes they're like 4 feet tall or so.
And, you know, And again, it could all be a perception of height based on a witness. It could be also, you know, very much the case, could have been. It sounds, your description of it sounds more in line with some of the slightly taller ones that are able to interact a little bit better with them. But one of the things, and this again points to, I think, some of the things I was mentioning just briefly a moment ago, is that a lot of people that encounter entities, they don't see a UFO. They don't go on board a UFO. Sometimes they do, and often they do, I should say. But sometimes there doesn't actually appear to be any sort of craft involved. You have somebody that's in a city or at least a well enough populated place where, you know, they're not going to be able to park their UFO easily.
Mm-hmm.
And yet these entities can come through. They can come through the wall. They can, you know, vanish, you know, reappear. They can do all sorts of unusual things. And to me, I think that is an additional indicator that their technology is at such a high rate, at such a high level,
mm-hmm.
that it's possible that wherever they are coming from, they don't even need craft to get to us. They just, you know, cut a little hole through the veil and they pop through
and they are
able to go back in, you know, where they came from. And I think a lot of these very personal, up-close experiences don't always involve UFOs, and so it makes them very difficult to investigate. You're not going to get a radar return off the UFO they landed in, you know, because there was no UFO, and there's not going to be outside witnesses outside the person's home because they were able to do a direct point of entry right into that person's house. They will come at a time where, you know, they know that we're the most vulnerable, and you know, they'll leave it so that there's absolutely no fingerprints and impossible to actually prove that it happened, and yet our memories of it function exactly like they do, as if, you know, we're just remembering what we had for lunch the previous day or,
mm-hmm.
or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, they are real, authentic memories of actual events that, you know, that we're unable to demonstrate to the world, like, hey, look, you know, you can tell hundreds of thousands of these very similar stories, which we do, and yet everyone says, you know, where's the smoking gun? Where's the proof? You know, and you just have to say, you know, sorry, they're just that much better than us. And if you hear enough of these stories, then you hear the similarities in them amongst people that had,
right.
you know, no chance
right.
to talk to each other.
Exactly.
You know,
that's the way I look at it.
Consistency.
That's the way I look at it too, Bill. It's like, how can all these stories before this all became publicized with Whitley Strieber kind of kicking things off back in 1980 or whatever? Before that, there really wasn't a lot of, I guess, Betty and Barney. What was it, Hill? I mean, mm-hmm. that was pretty well known, but there really wasn't a lot of people. There weren't a lot of people going down that road, and so for all these people to say the same thing, you know, I find that to be more than a coincidence. I want to ask you before we run out of time, and we'll have you back on again if you don't mind.
Great.
Is there anything to this explosion in Alpena? Do you know anything about that?
Explosions are actually a lot more common than you think.
Mm-hmm.
There was, just a couple months ago, one in southwest Michigan. You hear these loud explosions. There's no visible signs of anything happening. In fact, in the one that we had down here, that it was fairly close to Kalamazoo, a gentleman heard the explosion. He ran out of his house and saw two trees in his front yard were cut pretty much at the halfway point and toppled over. And he's like, you know, what just happened here? One of our investigators in the States who has been really trying to focus a lot of his time on this, his theory, and to me, the jury is still out, because to me, that's strange, but his theory is that he thinks it's seismic activity that is, you know, basically imperceptible, and yet we're hearing the audible after effects of it. And so he's still looking into it. He's one of the best investigators I think MUFON has. So, but as far as it being anything UFO-related, I don't see a direct link there. But what exactly is it? Yeah, I don't know.
Hmm. Okay, I thought I'd ask you before we ran out of time. We only got about a few more minutes on this. If somebody has something they want to report, what's the best way to go about doing that, Bill?
I would go to MUFON.com, M-U-F-O-N. That's Mutual UFO Network. So MUFON.com. There is, in the top right-hand corner, a little link you can click, and it'll pull up the report form. Or, if I may also promote the state's website, which is MI for Michigan, MUFON.org. And there you'll find the same report form. There's also a Twitter feed from our state that which does highlight some of the more recent sightings of interest. We just started that up. We even got a Facebook page that's only a couple weeks old now. But
would you say that the sightings are increasing, decreasing, or about the same?
I would say the volume of sightings that we're getting is increasing. We nowadays, over the last several years, we average about 250 sightings just in Michigan, mm-hmm. a year to us, to MUFON, directly to us, about 250 sightings. And I think it's just a matter of people knowing who to report their sightings to.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the level of UFO activity has probably been fairly static for a long, long time. And I think this just represents what we're hearing is just a percentage of what is, you know, probably into the low thousands of every year of sightings people see in Michigan.
Now you, and, I know we only got about a minute or two to go, Bill. You had told me in an email, I think you had mentioned something about sightings that go back to before 1900?
Yeah, one of the earliest sightings that I was able to pull up was in the late 1800s, there were actually, they looked like blimps, oddly enough, back then, which is a whole other category of strangeness, why they would look like blimps. But these aircraft were doing fantastic maneuvers, and people all over the country were seeing them. And Michigan, in fact, was one of the states that were getting a lot of these different sightings. If I remember correctly, it was the 1870s. But there was one of those sightings over Kalamazoo was very well witnessed and, in fact, made it into the local paper that these airships were flying around doing maneuvers that whatever scant number of airships were actually in the air at the time, they were impossible for them to do. And after a short time, maybe about a month or two, these sightings just stopped.
Hmm. Interesting.
And a friend of mine who's Native American, she had said, because I asked her once, said, you know, she's very well-grounded and connected with her ancestry, and I had asked, I said, you know, if you don't mind me asking, you know, do your people have any UFO stories? And she goes, our people have been seeing stuff well before you guys got here.
Mm-hmm.
She goes, this has been around a long, long time.
Hmm. Makes you wonder. I definitely believe that somebody's been interacting. And on an ending note, and we'll continue this again maybe when you have a little more time, do you think that there are those here that are malevolent and benevolent? Do you think there's both visiting?
Yes, and I think both of those terms are from our subjective perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they probably have a whole other sense of morals than we do.
Mm.
And whatever they base their moral compass on, I do think some of them, it's in their way not to hurt us, and others, they could care less.
Mm.
I don't know that any are here specifically to do us harm out of any sort of personal joy or like they want to invade the planet or anything. I don't get a strong vibe of that, but I do get a vibe that some of them just don't care.
They don't worry about it. Well, I appreciate your time. William, can you pronounce your name again, please, Bill?
Konkoleski.
Yep. And he's with Michigan MUFON. He is the director. He's been there since 2004. And again, if you have any sightings or if you just want to find out more about sightings, you can go to the website MIMUFON.org, and I'm guessing you have up-to-date sightings that you're always investigating, so
yes, indeed.
People can look at that.
And if anybody's listening, wants to become a member, wants to investigate UFOs, we certainly have our share in the Upper Peninsula that are difficult for us to investigate because most of our members are in Southeast Michigan, unfortunately. So please consider joining us.
All right. Thank you very much, Bill.
Well, thank you.
Music on Out There, created by Kevin MacLeod.